You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone, once again. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 5th, very early in the morning, the 5th of April, 2026. Back in 2006-2007, wrote an article for the American Journal of Russian and Slavic Studies, which of course was my own, called The Virtual Empire, The Case of Serbia and the Murder of Slobodan Milosevic. And I wrote that in response to one of the worst articles on Serbia ever written. And that's saying something. It was from Newsday, and it was called Serbs Finally Look Within. And it just repeated the same mantras that have been said about Serbia over the last, this is, you know, 90s, early 2000s. The nonsense that Serbs from Bosnia killed 7,500 defenseless Muslims at Srebrenica. Without bothering to mention that this was the headquarters of the 28th Infantry Division of the Bosnian Muslim Army. Remember, in the mid-90s, the regime was saying it was 250,000 rape camps and torture centers and all this nonsense. All of that, of course, has been abandoned. There's not a shred of evidence that Serbs killed anyone in this region. That was not part of a combat operation. Bosnian Serb irregulars against the Bosnian army is pretty much what happened. Any bodies that have been found, the most important one by a Spanish team of investigators, they were all men of combat age, in and out of uniform on both sides. There were major forensic examinations made. And all deaths were, in essence, combat deaths. So it was all nonsense. If you remember back then, the regime's media was saying this is the single deadliest action in Europe since World War II. Now, even if this were true, it's still remarkable that every single news source on the war, without exception, used that phrase, used that exact same wording, which proved monopoly and conspiracy. The other slogan that was used was anti-Muslim sentiment was deliberately stoked by Slobodan Milosevic. Well, gee, I wonder if that had anything to do with the murders of Serbs in Kosovo in the 1980s and 90s, or the Islamic declaration of the now-deceased Bosnian president Izetbegovic, calling for a purified Islamic state in Bosnia. Remember, he was supported by Patty Ashdown, the NATO system in general throughout the war. What Russians are today, Serbs were yesterday. Serbs have been herded into camps by Hungarians, slaughtered by Ottomans, murdered en masse by the Ustasha, assaulted daily in Kosovo, decimated by Tito, and, of course, Operation Keelhaul. Who could forget Operation Keelhaul? The Germans, of course, World War II, did not want to invade Yugoslavia. They didn't want to invade Greece, but why did they do it? To come to the rescue yet again of that clown, Mussolini, who failed in everything he ever did militarily. That's the only reason that Germany was in North Africa, that they were in Greece, that they were in Yugoslavia. Back then, I said that Serbs represent everything that the regime, the virtual empire, hates. Agrarian, orthodox, communal. And they have a strong record of defeating powers more significant than themselves. Serbian social and political history reads as one long ideological nightmare for the West. The unity of the warrior ethic with that of the monastic ethic that combined into a single ethnic nexus based around resistance and independence. And that's a quote from me. And Milosevic, despite being a totally secular man, was recreating this, maybe, you know, against his own wishes. But Serbia proved the smug West wrong about the past in nearly every single point. The agrarian life can produce a militarily strong power as well as any mechanized industrialized state can. Last week, we were talking about the institutions of medieval Serbia. And the Serbs were alone back then, and this is what got me to write the book that's now 20 years old precisely, The Manifestation of Holiness, Heavenly Serbia, and the Medieval Idea. The Bosnian Muslims made no secret that a unified Islamic Bosnia was their goal. That means a declaration of war on the Serbian population. The regime assumes correctly that only a handful of specialists would ever really know about this, and even among them, few would care. Hundreds of thousands of Serbs were killed or driven from their homes in Bosnia and Kosovo. The handful of Serbs left in Kosovo needed a police escort to go grocery shopping, when they had money to go. The Albanians who controlled the utilities would shut down power only in their areas. At the same time, they were completely dehumanized by the regime. And I was actually using the term regime 20 years ago and talked about the dehumanization that represents the very apogee of capitalist, postmodern liberal democracy and the people who truly control it. Once the war was over, of course, we all know what happened. Yugoslavia was, for better or for worse, a thing of the past, and it was recreated under the so-called free market reforms, financed by international debt. The point, of course, was to create a safe haven for foreign investors. Had nothing to do with any reconstruction of the economic infrastructure of the place. The IMF's absolutely failed and miserable, if not lethal, austerity was imposed, and any kind of national economy was dismantled. And that means that European and American banks would take over. And whatever was left in terms of industrial enterprises would be driven into bankruptcy. Whatever was left of state-owned assets would be transferred to the hands of foreign capital. And that was the point of this. But there were many reasons that the regime was obsessed with Serbia at the time. She was located astride the oil pipelines from South Russia to Central Asia. Milosevic was creating a system that was a nightmare for regime elites. Kosovo is one of the wealthiest areas in Europe. It sits upon a massive store of mineral wealth. Reminds one of the pompous cliches thrown around in South Africa in the 1980s, and for the same reason. Slobodan Milosevic, of course, was brought in front of the NATO's tribunal, so-called court, and was murdered there. And he was murdered because he was a standing embarrassment to the regime's so-called court in the Netherlands. It was created by NATO. It was created on orders from Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton. Milosevic was destroying the prosecution. And he was such a threat that the court needed to shout him down at certain critical moments. They tried to impose a lawyer on him. And he said, no, I don't trust any of these people. I want to defend myself. Then once one accusation was proven faulty or non-existent, they invented a new one. And so the trial dragged on for 4 years, and not one shred of evidence to convict the man, even under the crooked conditions of the regime's own court. The man was kept under harsh conditions, solitary confinement, bright light shining 24 hours a day, with every move of his watched and monitored by cameras. He wasn't allowed to meet with helpful defense witnesses. He wasn't even allowed the use of computers. He was reduced to writing parts of his defense on little scraps of paper and even starting to use his hand. So after 4 years, the case falling apart, Milosevic embarrassing the regime for its hypocrisy and lies, suddenly his doctors, during a routine checkup, found something weird. Pompicin, was a foreign drug in his system, very rare. It's used to treat lepers, with all the symbolism that that implies. But it also interferes with everything else, especially heart medication. Milosevic had never heard of this before, and he said, they're poisoning him. And the regime can say, well, he had heart problems, so, you know, he was on his way out anyway. And the trial came to an end, and Milosevic had shredded all of his opponents. The regime got nothing. It was a failure from NATO's point of view. And after he was murdered, he was then exonerated by the court. But of course, drug dealers and mafia figures took over Kosovo with American money. The regime obviously murdered him. And the fact that it was a drug used to treat lepers, and the fact that he was a social leper, that should give you a great pause, as I said at the time. And with all of this is why I wrote the book. There was so much garbage, many of you remember, in the late 90s and early 2000s about Serbia. I was defending Serbia when I was still in grad school. And it was extremely difficult because, remember, the web had just really came on in 96. But it's still very important to understand Serbia's sense of itself. Why did they develop this? And their medieval system was a very just one. I think last week we talked about the Zadruga, elected by village elders. He held court. The Župan, who was the chief executive, who was elected, carried out the decisions of the Zadruga, distributed work among members, oversaw, you know, tax collection, everything else. The Župan was an elected executive. The word means region, and in a more ancient sense, it also means shepherd. The Emperor of Constantinople made mention of the Župan, actually, saying that he ruled with a council made up of heads of the various rods or villages. So the political life of medieval Serbia was built from the bottom up. Serbia always maintained its autonomy as a part of the Byzantine Commonwealth until Emperor Dušan, Stephen Dušan, who conquered roughly half the lands of the Byzantine Empire, because the empire, which was, of course, dying and was going through a period of the mindless civil wars, so he had many, many Greeks under his jurisdiction. So medieval Serbia ultimately was a loose collection of clans under Aleksandar Župan. A national feeling was absolutely present. There were times when the clan would have to unite against a common foe. There was a common language, and there was a common Orthodox faith. Decentralization, though, was a problem because it invited invasion. I think I mentioned that last week. So the nation itself, then, was led by the Grand Župan, a primordial attempt at unity, living in a fortified citadel, or the Grad. So the heads of the villages, or the Selo, would send representatives to the conciliar meetings, bishops and abbots. It was a representative system, and these councils were called sebors, obviously coming from Sobor in Russian. And it existed at all levels. All classes were represented. From among the national sebor was drawn a council that always was meeting and advised the Grand Župan. There's no documents available that show us any decision-making without it. In Montenegro, the sebor were assemblies of warriors who arrived at meetings completely armed. They were free men in the true sense, not the modern sense, but in the true sense. They decided on peace and war, which makes a lot of sense since they alone had to fight it. The big drawback there was they still engaged in the blood feud, which was a huge problem. But both Orthodox and royal power, which ultimately was combined into one, the prince-bishop, tried to control it with some success, but... And we talked about the significance of both Stepan Nemanja and St. Sava. I also mentioned that in Serbian history, there was no such concept of serfdom or slavery. The closest you could come is people who were deep in debt. Whether you were noble, whether you were common, everyone had hereditary property rights, and anyone could petition the crown. Commoners showed no servility in the face, even of the monarch. They would give the king a kiss, showing brotherly affection on both cheeks. It was equality, but an equality with honor, a devotion to station. I think I mentioned the two forms of nobility, which is very important. Nobility, Vlastela. You had the greater and lesser in the charter of Stepan Juros in 1264. But, you know, even among them, crimes were adjudicated according to one law. It was only punishments that differed. Two forms of noble property, the bashtina, or the hereditary tenure, and the pronia, land in return for service. That was purely a usufruct system. Usufruct means, it comes from the Latin, two terms, usus and fructus. Usus, we get the word use from, and fruit, fructus, as in the fruits of one's labor. You could profit from something without actually owning it. Commoners were known as free men, slobodni ljudi. They held independent bashtina. Their responsibility was identical to that of nobles, so the distinction between nobility and free men were non-existent. Commoners were represented in the Grand Sabor. The property rights of all commoners were protected by law. Commoners could hold bastina, could hold any form of property. One of the most interesting parts of the law code at the time, eventually codified by Stepan Dušan, this is actually Article 68, but it had existed in many regions before, that nothing can be extracted from a laborer that is not an aspect of law or is devised therefrom. In other words, something, you know, you have a contract, you have an agreement, and if a lord wants more work than the agreement provides for, you can go to the monarchy. Any kind of exaction, any kind of rent seeking gave the tenant the right to take the lord to the imperial court. That's also in Article 139. It actually says the crown takes full responsibility for seeing that the lord exacts no revenge against the tenant who takes him to court. Every tenant was given, and this is a free man, was given 9 mats. Each mat was about 2/3 of an acre. That was the case, especially in monasteries. The harvest was delivered to the monks. Certainly the farmers there received sufficient land to live. And in return, the monastery maintained a relief store for the community and consistently assisted the poor and the widowed, and this was their schooling system as well. Single men especially worked as a community, working for the monastery maybe 2 days a week. One male from each house needed to put in that work, which for large families didn't mean a whole lot. I think we mentioned the vlasti, or the cattle raisers. They were migratory. Sometimes I wonder if some of them may have been what we would call gypsies today. They were unpopular. Their wanderings often caused damage to property. But if they were attached to any specific local body, they owed service like anyone else. In wartime, they were used not so much as soldiers, but they were used as guides. Because they were wanderers, they knew the area extremely well. And the lowest, so I've already mentioned the otrok. There were very few of them. They did have private property rights. but they were usually chronic debtors or otherwise a criminal problem. And I've seen this in documents from Dubrovnik, the great trading city. But once their debt was paid, they became normal Serbian citizens again. And keep in mind the concept of debt and to transgress. Like in the Our Father, we say, you know, forgive our debtors. And in customary law, those are the same. So it's hard to tell whether Notruk was a debtor in a sense that he took out money he can't pay, or was just a petty criminal. Either way, personal service was a way to pay off a debt, whether literal or figurative. Justice was administered by the locality. A jury was a central concept in all of Serbian law. Tsar St. Milutin organized a body of judges educated in legal theory, and that was the backbone of the court system. In Article 179 of Dušan's Code, judges should travel the circuit to look after the affairs of the poor and to stop any form of oppression. It's kind of like the Misi of Charlemagne. You see this in many strong monarchs. Judges were forbidden to take property according to Article 180. Village courts presided over by a judge that was locally elected. You also had commercial courts, the Department of the Treasury, and you also had church courts. And all used the jury system. Sometimes it's hard to believe that the Tsar himself could be brought to an imperial court by a commoner. But Article 171 states the following. In case my imperial majesty should give to any person a note in anger or friendship or in grace, contrary to law and not according to justice, the judge will pay no heed to my writings and shall judge regularly according to the law and see to it that his judgment is made manifest. That by itself proves that Serbia was a nation ruled by law. Articles 112, 113, there's a right to asylum in the patriarch's or the king's court if someone's unjustly punished. You had a full habeas corpus procedure in the judicial system there. Writs were submitted beforehand to the judge. Rules of evidence were normally based on witnesses or written documents. Trials tended to be verbal, but sentences were always written. This is a very literate society. A hung jury, suggesting that there has to be a unanimous decision. A hung jury was sent to the capital for decision by the sovereign himself through the imperial court system. The accuser had to be there. He was innocent until proven guilty. You see this Article 89 of the code. The officer of the court, the pristav, somewhat like a sheriff, could on occasion work as a free defense attorney. But the law of service was very strict. You had to be served an injunction in person. Tongues were cut out for transgressing any of these laws or rules. Serbs were always judged by juries of their peers. Protonisi, juror, made up of commoners, nobles, merchants can only be judged by merchants, etc. Even Otroks were judged by others of their class. If there was a mixed class case, say a free peasant suing a noble, the jury had to be mixed in proportion. Church courts, of course, were very similar. Issues of public morality, marriage, divorce, blasphemy, anything like that. Divorce was granted in fairly rare cases. Men and women who abandoned their homes had to go back. Women who left their husbands for another man were given lashes. And men, worse, public humiliation. You didn't have a prison system, of course. But confiscation of property was a fairly rare punishment. That was reserved for things like murder, treason, or forgery. Manslaughter, bodily injury, rent-seeking, that would be fines and public beatings. If you had someone on the jury who you knew, that juror was then fined 1,000 perpers, which was the currency of the day. A perper was roughly two-thirds of a modern bushel, so modern bushel, 60 pounds, so you're talking about 40 pounds of wheat. Serbia was in a very strategic location. So abuses of power, robbery, overtaxation, things like that. When you're dealing with a major land route from Western Europe to the Orient, robbery and a lack of control of public roads was a big deal. Serbia always had an importance disproportionate to its size. Restitution, really, is typical of the Middle Ages. It's a primary form of punishment, whether in money or in kind, usually in kind. So foreign merchants, usually from Ragusa and Dubrovnik, they're the same place, coming from Venice. If they were robbed by Serbs, the Tsar then would be totally responsible for restitution. Robbery was almost completely wiped out in Serbia before the Turkish invasion. Military service was required of all freemen. The only exception were those working church lands. The most common levy was the nobles, the army of their retainers, all coming at their own cost. That was a severe responsibility. And the second was the Zemanjska Vojska. All nobles, retainers, commoners, the whole male population, only in emergency. So those who held land, actually owned it, that type of noble, was the backbone of the army. Light infantry, commoners usually used a lance and a battle axe, depending on circumstances. The velocity, as I mentioned, were transport men. The officer cavalry was noble. The Tsar was supreme commander and usually led his men personally. The Sabor alone could declare war in consultation with the monarchy. Sometimes, I think I mentioned this too, the sovereign could maintain an army of mercenaries. But they cannot be trusted. Merchants, that way of life was looked down on. But sometimes those from Dubrovnik, Ragusa, themselves connected to Venice, which themselves in turn connected to the Jews, sometimes were given special privileges in Serbia, but very strictly related privileges. Uprisings against them were very common. There was one, the first one that exists, that dates from the era of Stefan Nemanja himself, signed in Dubrovnik in 1186. But a lot of taxes were paid by Ragusans into the treasury. So, take all this into consideration. Medieval Serbia was fairly wealthy, but strictly nationalist, based on family loyalty, national property, and general equality among classes. I used to call it an ethno-communalist form of government, or even a form of society. Outside of military levies in wartime, the Grand Zupan had little day-to-day effect on the Serbian population, who, like in Russia, were ruled by elected local leaders and always judged by a jury of their peers in a strict sense of the term. One of the greatest legal documents of the Middle Ages, as I've mentioned already, the Code of Emperor Dušan of Serbia, the Emperor of the Serbs and the Greeks, 1308-1355. Law in the Middle Ages is always a crystallization of traditions and institutions that had come before, usually a matter of custom. The distinction between law and custom was almost non-existent. When it was written down, it essentially calcified custom and tradition, making it available to all. But it needs to be understood as an abbreviation of long-standing practice. Words are often very weak in what it contains. Practice is a totally different story. Now, the Emperor Dušan, the first and only Serbian monarch to have that title, conquered territories, tremendous territories, in fact, of the weakened Byzantine Empire. The civil war between Kentakuzenos and John V, this horrible, meaningless war in the 1340s, and he played both sides off against each other, and really without much effort, without any major battle in the field, Dušan took half of Byzantine lands from it, doubled the territory of Serbia. But military operations, there were usually sieges, and they didn't offer resistance for very long. If there were Greek areas, their customs were always maintained. And St. Sava's, when he translated the Nomocon, the Code of Law, but that also, remember, contained laws of property and exchange and even class. So that was connected with Dušan's code. He also had the agricultural law and certain statutes of the Emperor Justinian translated from the Greek, especially those regulating the relations among peasants. Dušan's code was a unification of both Serbian and Byzantine legal systems and legal ideas throughout one state. Of course, he had to strengthen the central government, consolidation. But as we all know, and my whole career has really been based around this one thing, that monarchy is absolutely necessary because nobility, if left to themselves, will become an oligarchy. And when Dušan was away in campaign, local nobles became very powerful. So there was a temporary peace, 1349. Dušan was able to focus on domestic concerns. And it was the Sabor at Skopje, the Feast of the Assumption, May 21st, 1349. Presence of the Patriarch, representatives of the church, nobles of every rank, the code was proclaimed. And many of the procedures I've already mentioned. Legality is central. The law is above every representative of power. The law is above the emperor. Now again, everyone was equal before the law. That didn't preclude estates, because estates are part of natural law. Certain groups have certain specialties, certain responsibilities. And therefore, punishing them, given their different responsibilities, is of course going to take different forms. It wasn't uncommon for a free man or a dependent farmer or even a herder to take legal action against his lord. In most places in Europe, that was out of the question. So when you talk about a medieval law code, nothing in there is new. It tends to be a matter of consolidation. In my book, I took a few of my favorite sections of the code, and put them in context. Like, for example, Article 29. In all churches, the poor shall be fed, as is written by all the church fathers. Should any metropolitan or bishop or archpriest fail to feed them, he will be deprived of his rank. Churches, monasteries, especially monasteries, were a huge part of the Serbian national idea. Its infrastructure, the monasteries founded by St. Sava were placed in strategic areas. In both Byzantium and Serbia, it had to have a hospital with a minimum of 12 beds, using the, at the time, advanced Greek forms of medicine. Life expectancy was about 73 to 75, generally speaking. You have to take out infant mortality, though. You have to take that out of the – you want to figure an average, you have to take that out. But the goal was the ascetic life in a monastery. But you also have to take the words of Christ seriously in the matter of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked. What did Christ say would happen if you don't do this? Nothing short of hell. Serbia never had a secularization campaign like you had in Russia under Catherine the Great or England under Henry the Eighth. Article 117. A customs officer of the Tsar is not authorized to hinder or to detain any merchant in order to force him to sell his merchandise at a very low price. Everyone is free to travel to all markets and to move with his merchandise as he wishes. No lord, either small or great, nor any other, may detain or hinder his men or other merchants to go to the market of the Tsar, but let everyone go freely. Well, in one way, this is forbidding any internal barriers to trade, which is very significant, but it has a deeper meaning. It's a way to control local lords who wanted to take and use merchant capital for their own purposes. You see, the notion of an internal trade barrier is identical to a local lord who wants to become an oligarch. So this article is aimed at nobles who attempted to control or were controlling territories along the Montenegrin coast to forbid internal tariffs imposed by, you know, the local nobility. The Tsar was setting himself above them, and really what's their narrow economic interest. So whenever central authority was weakened after the death of Dushan, for example, local nobles with significant trade within their realms began coining their own money. That's, you know, a major step in becoming an oligarch. Coining one's own money, the most significant, possibly the most significant statement of political independence. So having control over the merchants of the realm was a major step in solidifying some modicum of central control. Article 134, I've already mentioned it, but it's worth talking about. No master is authorized to do anything contrary to the law to agricultural workers within the Tsar's land. Only what the Tsar has written in the code. It shall labor and give to their lords. If he do something illegal to his worker, the Lord Tsar orders that every worker be authorized to litigate with his master, or with the Tsar, with the Lady Tsaritsa, or with the church, the lords of the Tsar, with anybody. He shall be authorized to withhold him from the court of the Tsar, but let judges judge him according to justice. If the worker win the lawsuit against his master, let the judge of the Tsar guarantee the way the master shall pay all to the worker at the appointed time. And let that master be not authorized to do any harm to the worker afterwards. I mentioned that above. There's no the concept of retaliation is specifically mentioned in the law code. It's remarkable. In an oligarchy, that could never be. Modern labor, of course, is dominated by oligarchic interests. There's not much you can do in a world of conglomerates to redress any kind of grievance, especially with no union. Now, of course, there were no serfs in Serbia, but any peasant, any agricultural worker of any type could appeal to the Tsar himself. Now, populations were fairly low back then. You're not talking about cities of millions of people. It's about the violation of contract. There you have recourse to the church or even authorities above them, the secular realm. I mean, the local parish, I don't know what I mean, or the local monastery. It doesn't have many parallels elsewhere, but it does require a very strong monarchy to enforce it. Article 137. To the lords and lesser lords, to whom the Tsar has given land and towns, if any one be found to have plundered villages, people and ruined them, outside the Tsar's law, which he has enacted in the council, in the Sabor, let his estate be taken from him, and let him pay for what he has ruined from his own house, and be punished as a runaway. What that means is that he's essentially abandoned his role. He's abandoned his station. Again, the issue is the independence of local nobles using towns within their jurisdiction for their own purposes. And again, the Tsar is setting himself above them. That means peasants and other workers within any jurisdiction had the same rights as a noble before the Tsar. True lordship is aristocratic, not oligarchic. An aristocrat, that's one of service, the maintenance of unity and the protection of church land. The cultural integrity of a territory, that's what an aristocrat does. It's a matter of self-sacrifice. Article 146. The imperial order. From now henceforward, let there be a jury for great matters and small ones. For a great matter, let there be 24 jurors, and for a lesser one, 12. And for a small matter, 6. And these jurors shall not be authorized to make peace between the parties, but to acquit or else convict. Let every jury meet in a church, and the priest shall be in his vestments, and he will swear them in. And whatever the majority of the jury swear, whatever they acquit, that shall be believed. Now, I don't think it was a mere majority, but possibly in the small matters it may have been. But in great matters, it had to be far more than that. Jurors were always peers. So today it would be something like a manual worker only being judged by other manual workers. And those sharing the same ethnic background, language, and place of residence, a true peer. It was rare for anyone to go into the church and swear and lie. As I mentioned, they cut tongues out for violation. Toussaint says that the priest that administers the oath to jurors has to be fully vested. That's not a statement of fashion. Choosing jurors, the swearing in, was a liturgic event, part of the regular services of the church. It's not spelled out. But in this context, you know, confession, Holy Communion, fasting, there were also aspects of juridical proceedings, making it a sacred and liturgical function. Now, it wasn't a sacrament, of course, but it took on something like that. A little bit later, Article 149, when jurors acquit someone on oath according to the law, and after the acquittal, guilt be proven genuinely against the one whom they've acquitted, let the Tsar exact from those jurors a fine of 1,000 purpurs each, and afterward those jurors shall not be believed about anything. And if they be found to have knowingly, wrongfully acquitted, or given up, or taken a bribe, or having paid as aforesaid, they shall be confined in another unfamiliar region. This is a nice way of saying they were sent into exile. So you clearly had a system of appeals. 1,000 purpurs, that's something like 40,000 pounds of grain. That certainly worked to maintain a pure justice system. If hell didn't motivate them, then years and years and years of work might. In the U.S., there are no punishments for jurors who carry out miscarriages of justice, and we've seen that over the last few years. You know, James Field being one of them, the policeman in Minneapolis being another one. So many of them. Counterclaims were forbidden. Article 156. There were so many built-in walls to deal with abuses to the point where it got fairly complex. So the anger of a man, say in Article 156, who is brought before a jury is dealt with. In American system, especially in small claims, an irritated defendant will bring up a counterclaim, which is usually dismissed immediately, just out of a wish for revenge. But that sort of thing is forbidden here. Very importantly, Article 163, goldsmiths may nowhere dwell in the districts and in the lands of the Tsar, save in the market towns where the Tsar hath determined that money may be minted. Now, a normal person will read this, shrug his shoulders, and move on. But the article is extremely important. Unity was a central concern of all Serbian czars over anything else. This article about goldsmiths is about forbidding the coining of money by local lords. Goldsmiths were the coiners of money, among other things. That means they needed to be watched by the state. It was a guild that was under very close supervision. They needed to live in that kind of environment rather than risk being contracted out to some elite who wanted to coin their own currency. The Western lords, many Latins, and some just blatant heretics, even beyond Latinism, attempted to lure Serbian goldsmiths away from the towns to coin money as a means to express an attack on orthodoxy. This was almost a bribe in and of itself. Article 172. All towns which are in the lands of the Tsar shall be under the law, as they were in the times of previous Tsars, for disputes which they have among themselves, let them be tried before the prefect of the towns and before the clergy. If a man from a district sue a citizen, let him sue before the prefect of the town and before the clergy according to law. Now, in and of itself, it doesn't seem all that interesting. But that's about the territorial integrity of the nation. of the previous Tsars. He's talking about, you know, Dragutin, Milutin, anyone after the great founder of the line. These were major expansionist monarchs who protected the lands of Serbia against the Venetians. Of course, the significance that some towns could not decide their own fate. They were part of an integral Serbian state, regardless of very specific local privileges that they may have enjoyed. Substantial decentralization existed, yes, but it didn't stretch to converting to heresy. The fact that there needed to be specific forms of legal proceeding among towns means that they were part of a larger entity that could act as a mediator among them, their marketplaces, and more importantly, their goldsmiths. Town means is grad in Serbian. These were fortified areas that were designed as a military, as part of a military infrastructure throughout the country. A marketplace might be situated within it, but either way, a garrison was always there. Population was maybe a few hundred, not including the retinue of the local lord who may have resided there. By placing garrison among towns in the hands of the courts of the Tsar, there's another way of saying that the garrisons found within the grad were not the personal property of the noble, but part of the integral Serbian unity. I can't stress the importance here and how tremendous it is. But ethnicity was a huge part of it. But there was not a huge distinction in Serbia between orthodoxy and ethnicity. This was the backbone of the Orthodox Church. It's right within the canons themselves. You know, the rise of the Franks in the west, the Christianization of Bulgaria to the north, it was this huge simultaneous expansion of the church just prior to the formal date of the schism, 1054. Now, 1054 is not some magical date. It had been papal policy for some time to Latinize the entire Balkan Peninsula, which is, you know, an aspect of the sack of Byzantium in 1204. Now, that's probably the real date of the final Western schism, is 1204. That period of time in between, you had plenty of Orthodox sees that did have Western Rite Orthodox parishes. I mean, St. Photius, Patriarch of Constantinople, used the mission of St. Cyril and Methodius to counter papal designs in the area. But liturgy being done in Slavic, that was an ethnic bulwark against Latinization. But when Byzantium fell to the Fourth Crusade, that's when the work of Serbian unity began. The institutional outlines of an independent Serbian church and liturgical tradition were to be found. So from the beginning of Christianization, on the one hand, the granting of Serbian autocephaly on the other, St. Sava, you're talking about four centuries. Now, Latinization of the Serbian coastlands doesn't necessarily mean that they were not Orthodox. But sometimes it did. I think I mentioned last week, this concern is why St. Sava left for Nicaea. Of course, you know, Constantinople itself was occupied. Nicaea more than, you know, went above and beyond in maintaining the tradition of the best aspects of the Byzantine Empire. But given the fact that Constantinople had fallen temporarily, the morale of local lords was very low. And the popes were able to use this to their advantage. Church independence and the existence of the Slavic liturgical language, that helped put a stop to this. And when St. Stepan Nemanja took what we call, you know, Zita or Montenegro today, that helped put a stop to Latin pressure there for a time. The history of the church, and this is the case in most places, but most certainly in Serbia and definitely in Montenegro, the history of the church has been forged in the crucible of suffering. It almost never came into existence there. You're talking about the immense wealth of Venice, acting as a papal battering ram, major trading post along the Adriatic, And of course, as I mentioned many times, especially in Dubrovnik, Ragusa, that was the fear. St. Sava went back to Athos to recruit his bishops for one reason, because the Athenites could be trusted. It was on the Feast of the Ascension, 1221, at their national sabor. It was held at Zica Monastery. That's when the Kingdom of Serbia was officially proclaimed as a Christian and monastic entity. Sava made sure that his own successors in the church would be just like him, both scholarly and deeply ascetic. He had to move the see to Pest in 1253. They were worried about invasions. The bishop there, Saints Nicodem and Danilo II, were first-rank scholars and translators. Again, bringing the best of Greek, Roman, Byzantine culture to Serbia. In fact, Archbishop Danilo's work on the history of Serbian kings had remained for a long time the only significant source on information about them. There are not many documents on Serbia prior to the foundation of the line of Nemanja. In Skopje, in 1346, Tsar Dušan finally called this a sabor to proclaim the See of Pest as the Serbian Patriarchate. I think I mentioned this last week, but it had support in Bulgaria. Many Greek bishops, many from the Holy Mountain, were there to give their consent. Even the Byzantines recognized it in 1375. Monasteries were built in the great Serbian bishops. Especially as the Turks began to advance, Serbian monks fled to the protection of St. Lazar's realm. He became a hezekiah almost in and of himself. One of the great patriarchs was Ephraim, a hezekiah. The economy recovered to a great extent under Stepan Lazarevich, or Lazar's son. George Brankovich, who fought the Council of Florence. George was rejecting Latin aid, even though he knew he could only hold out for a very short time against the Turks. He, too, chose martyrdom over political expedience. This is why Serbia was a literate and cultured society. It was a monastic presence, knowing and acknowledging its debt to both Greek and Bulgarian teachers. Daily services were normal, not just in parishes and monasteries, but also in households. St. Nikolai says, Vmilovic says that in Serbia, each house became a little monastery. This is important when you consider the total destruction of the clergy when the Turks finally took over. You had no canonical clergy at all. So the father of the family, the head of the village, really, the Solo, the patriarch, was in charge then of liturgical work. Maybe there'd be a traveling priest somewhere, but it didn't matter. The Slava then became the central, but, you know, they all had their books in the village. Now, it's a shame that you have a situation where, as I said last week, where Bulgaria, Byzantium and Serbia had to fight one another, however briefly. It wasn't just a matter of so-called Catholics coming out of the Bay of Kotor or Venice. But the Monastery of St. Nicholas, for example, part of the Dabar diocese, it was there to confront the Bogomils, who early on were a severe problem. Essentially, Judaization. The tendencies towards secession for this reason, among the princes, local princes, it taught the church, Sava in particular, but the church in general. The church leader also needed to be a strong political figure. You have this in Montenegro. Sava was able to cross tribal feelings among specific geographical branches of Serbs and created a nation. Well, the nation was, of course, already there, but this is very early. They were subjectively aware of their unity. This does include Montenegro. That was one of his greatest achievements. Yes, some made agreements with the Latins at Leon for a union. But because the Slav Church in Serbia was independent, and everything was done in its local language, and had, you know, feast days and liturgical services that were unknown in the West, their inroads could be ignored. And it was the Greek patriarch Callistos who excommunicated the Serbian church. But this was over Serbian expansion. Small revolts carried out by Greek clergy against Serbian domination of the new lands of the empire. But in 1355, Dušan died. And unfortunately, with him, the leadership necessary to maintain the Orthodox Empire. His son was unable to stop these tendencies. Prince Lazar of the Morava River, Patriarch Sava IV, Isaiah of Athos, met together to plan a defense of a weakened Serbia against the Turks. And it was because of the great Athenites, able to smooth things over, both with the Turks and with the Greeks. Patriarch Sava IV died in 1375, but his position was tough to fill. At the time, the church didn't speak with a unified voice. So they settled on Ephraim, the former hermit in Bulgaria. But someone like him, very, very holy and a true elder, he wasn't up to the challenge politically. It doesn't reflect badly on him, but the severity of the situation and Spyridon took his place, and that's where the famous Battle of 1389 took place. Stepan Lazarevich is able to exploit Turkish weakness by playing off Hungary and Turkey. He still had some mines under his control, as I've mentioned before. Some of you may remember, I think it was in 2023, I dealt with the Despotate, the Serbian state that existed from 1402 when St. Stepan Lazarević received the title of despot from the Byzantine emperor, and it ended in 1459 when all of Serbia was finally conquered by the Turks. The Despotate existed only because of the law codes of Sava, of Nemanja, of Milutin, and of course, Dušan. The despots tried ideologically and institutionally to continue the tradition of the empire of Nemanja, but some of its leaders were very short-sighted. I mean, it had its work cut out for it. Its viability was always questionable. The Despotate was located between the very powerful Ottoman Empire and the Kingdom of Hungary. And the state's fortunes depended on its relations with both of them, not to mention the Venetian oligarchy. The defeat of the Despotate and the resulting Turkish occupation of the Balkans were brought about by some of the stupidest military and diplomatic policies of both the Greeks and the Serbs. Remember, Turks had a foothold on European soil by invitation because they were used as mercenaries by both Greeks and Serbs against their rivals for increasingly small chunks of land. Technically, Turkey was not an invader. Byzantine emperors like Andronikos invited them into Europe during his civil wars. Over and over again, Orthodox rulers sided with the Turks to get back at their Christian enemies. The leadership, even of Byzantium itself, refused to see Turks as a threat to Europe, maintaining the prejudice that it was impossible for the Queen of Cities to ever fall, or that the Turks had the power to occupy all the Balkans. It's like they had no idea what they were facing across the water, or were in a pathological state of denial over it. has more to do with the fact that many Balkan Orthodox princes sided with the Turks, entered into their service, even throughout the existence of the despotate. Serbian and Bulgarian infantry detachments were on the Turkish side even at the final siege of Constantinople in 1453. So you're looking at occupation, even possibly genocide, in the face. Greek and Serb leaders still worried more about settling old scores or avenging minor slights than standing against the Islamic Empire. And they continued to behave this way even after the area came under Islamic control. St. Lazare's son, Stefan, yes, he gained military experience by participating in the campaigns with Turkey, not against them, in Asia Minor. He was in the Turkish service. When the Bulgarian cities fell, Turkish incursions into Bosnia, Wallachia were constant. Most of their infantry was Orthodox. Talk about apostasy. They needed Serbian troops to supplement their own regular forces. That means the fall of Byzantium, the taking of the Balkans, that was hardly inevitable. The only reason the Turks were stopped roughly in, 1394, a little bit afterwards, was the invasion of Tamerlane, not the actions of Christian Europe. Returning from battle, Stefan and Vuk Lazarevic first went to Constantinople, but on their way, they noticed signs of new opportunities after the Battle of Angora, the same time the Byzantine Emperor Manuel himself was on a trip to the West to beg for assistance. But rather than use his authority to help unify the Orthodox powers of the Balkans, he went to the Catholics, who they knew had no intention of helping them. While in Paris, Manuel learned the defeat of the Turks to the Mongol leader. The fight was extended the life of the Byzantine Empire by maybe 50 years. As Emperor John VII had endowed Stefan in August of 1402, the first time with the title of despot. So Serbia increased in stature within the Commonwealth, but it didn't keep short-sighted Serbian princes from siding with the Turkish enemy over and over again. They thought this huge crusading army was going to come to rescue them because, there was so much precedent for those things. It never ended. None of this stuff was inevitable. What brought Constantinople down, what brought the Balkans down, including Serbia and Bulgaria, but not Montenegro. That was a whole separate matter, and I talked about that a long time ago. People like Dorad, the minute he had the chance, he fled to Suleiman and the Turks. He formed an army against Stefan strictly for personal reason. I could go on and on. Many of you remember that discussion. It's a miracle Christian Balkans lasted for as long as it did. And as much as it pains me to say it, the Turks were not really invaders. They were always being brought over by the empire itself. The entire Brankovici clan in Serbia was pro-Turkish. But what did they think would happen when the Ottomans were victorious? What do you think they would do to Christian lands there? Well, they would do what they'd done everywhere else. But Stepan also forced reconciliation with that same clan. And many Serbs were used to undercut rebellions against the Turks in Bulgaria. It was some of the most short-sighted policies, and I I strongly recommend you go back in 2023 to listen to that lecture on the despotate and the article, which is about 19 pages long, that I have on somewhere on Patreon. The Orthodox forces were put in an almost impossible situation. If you were a principal like Stefan, you had no choice. You had to either be assisted by the Venetians, the Hungarians, or go to the Turks, and that was out of the question. The Turks, long before the fall of Constantinople, were a major player in the military politics and coalitions of the Balkans. To the destruction of the system of medieval Serbia, which was truly just. It proves that nationalism existed in the Middle Ages to a great extent. And certainly the Serbian nationalism of Montenegro, which took a long time to conquer. None of that was inevitable. It's the eternal problem of being a fairly small country in a nasty neighborhood. You can't function by yourself. This is the Ukrainian problem. Independence, in the strict sense, is absolutely impossible. You have to be a part of a coalition. Members of that coalition hopefully are not Islamic and bent on your destruction, but they may not be Orthodox either, and you may not have a choice. Of course, ideally, you know, Greece, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, Montenegro, to be a little bit anachronistic about it. But given the politics of the late Byzantine era, that's not how it went. Yes, Dušan was a great leader, but it came at the expense of the Byzantine Empire. And Dušan noticed that those fighting the civil war then, and many civil wars that went came later, were using Turks as mercenaries, using Turks as both infantry and cavalry. They were already there. So when the place fell, it shouldn't have shocked anybody, and yet it did. They were surrounded by enemies, but this is exactly what created the Serbian mentality. Only unity saved the Serbs. It's right on the flag. The four C's that you see, it looks like, you know, English C. That's precisely what that means. Constant pressure, constant stress. And the institutions that I talked about over the last 2 weeks, the Zupanit, the Salo, the Sabor, all of this came into existence under those conditions. They were truly the structures of survival of this heroic Orthodox people. I'm proud to say I came into the Orthodox Church under the Serbs. The Ukrainians in Lincoln, but the Serbs in Washington D.C. And if it wasn't for individuals like Saint Sava, there would be no functional Serbia today, and possibly no Orthodox Church there today. Thank you, everyone, again for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye bye.